Welcome to Water of the Word, the radio ministry of Pastor Steve Hadley of Harvest Family Fellowship in Reno. Join us today as Pastor Steve continues through a verse-by-verse study of the powerfully prophetic book of Daniel. Follow along as Pastor Steve shows us the stunning precision of God's prophecies. At the same time, we'll see how God equipped and protected Daniel to walk in integrity and power while living in the midst of the most powerful and enticing culture the world had ever seen. So come on along. May we all be refreshed and inspired as we are washed by the water of the Word.
History geeks and freaks, are you ready? This is great stuff tonight. We are in Daniel chapter 5, verse 1. When people would detract from the credibility of the scriptures, this is one of the places that they would go. They would say, did you know that the book of Daniel, supposedly written 500 years B.C., mentions that the king of Babylon, at the time when King Cyrus the Great, who was a very well-known personage in history, did you know that your crazy Bible said that the king was Belshazzar? Everybody knows it wasn't him. It was a fella by the name of Nabonidus. Sounds like an ailment. How's your Nabonidus? Oh, I'm feeling a little bit better after I got some cream. Nabonidus, everybody knows that. Well, in the mid-1800s to late 1800s, there was a concerted effort by many archaeologists. And I like to mention them because sometimes God asks us to step out in faith on a number of perhaps principles. But I want you to notice something, that by and large, we don't have to check our brain at the door. The Bible has been about 80% archaeologically substantiated. And for the tape, if anybody's curious, and for me, I love this stuff. French archaeologists Paul-Émile Botha and Victor Place, British archaeologist Sir Austin Henry Layard, and Hormuz Hassam, and then, of course, the great German archaeologist Robert Koldewey. In the mid-1800s to the late 1800s into the early 1900s, these guys were digging and they found the city and the boundaries of the great city of Babylon. It laid out about 9 acres or so, and they knew that because of the foundations that were still intact, that those walls were huge. And then you cross-reference what the archaeologist Spade uncovered with the historical context and the historical mentionings, the walls of Babylon were upwards of 300 feet high. And then if you happen to get past that one, well, there was another wall behind that. And there were over 150 towers across the top that they could defend these amazing walls. You guys know how big 300 feet is? It's 30 stories. Find yourself a 30-story building, and that was the walls of Babylon. And they were so wide and so thick that they could race chariots across the top of the wall, 4 and 5 chariots abreast. Huge walls. And because the worst military weapon that could be leveled against the city was the siege, where they would say, fine, we're not going to try to get over your walls. We'll build a wall out here and put our forces between your big wall and our little earthen wall, and we'll just stop any groceries from coming in and being delivered into the city, or water. Well, Babylon was built on the Euphrates River. Big river, huge river. So choking off their water supply would be practically impossible. And then because of the foresight of the kings going all the way back to Hammurabi, 1600 BC, thereabouts, they would keep a huge storehouse of food and supplies. They had a couple of Walmarts inside all the time, completely and perfectly stocked. So it was estimated that they could withstand a siege of more than 25 years. And by that time, the besieging army would sort of give up and want to go home. So there they sat, and the archaeologists have proved this. In fact, it was Robert Caldwell who excavated what are called the Ishtar Gates. And he not only uncovered them, but he uncovered them in such pristine condition that he shipped them back to Berlin and they were reassembled. If you go to the big museum there in Berlin, there are the Ishtar Gates in their full height. Pictures of the Ishtar Gates reassembled for the viewing public. And you look at it and you go, they must have painted them and got them all spiffy. Nope, they are the same 500 or so BC that we're going to look at here tonight. Most scholars, they laughed at Daniel's account of Belshazzar as being king. Everybody knows it was Nabonidus. Until these guys started digging and poking around, and they begin to find a treasure trove of tablets and a little something called a cylinder. Go ahead. One of the things that this fellow Hormuz Hassam, he found this. This at one time was wet clay, and then a arrow-shaped stylus would poke into the wet clay, and you had to be kind of quick about it because, as you notice, you got to write all the way around. And then they would fire in a kiln, and then it would harden, and there it is. It was uncovered in one of the ruins of the foundation of one of their sort of priestly little huts that they had inside what would have been the walls of Babylon. And there it laid buried for almost 2,500 years. That's called the cylinder of Nabonidus, found about 1852 to 53. And when they were discerning what the cuneiform read, guess what it told the story of? We found out that Nabonidus is the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar, who here in chapter 5 has been gone about 20 years. Nabonidus married Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. And we find out from this cylinder and a couple others that were found that he spent most of his time not in Babylon, but across what would be the European and even Asian continent on military campaigns and actually preferred northern Arabia. And that's where he lived most of the time. And to finance his endeavors and adventures, he heavily taxed the people of Babylon and the people of the Babylonian Empire. And the city and empire, they were struggling. They were buckling under runaway inflation, resulting in a widening gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And there was tremendous unrest going on about the time that we're going to look at here in chapter 5. And there was even sporadic famine. The once great empire under Nebuchadnezzar and the beautiful resplendent city of Babylon had suffered under his son-in-law, according to the Nabonidus cylinder, that while he was gone, he put in charge of Babylon proper his eldest son, Belshazzar. Now nobody says boo about Belshazzar, chapter 5, Daniel verse 1. Well, the archaeologist Spade has confirmed once again what your Bible says. Also, I wanted to mention the idols of the cities that were sort of loaned outside of the walls for the people to bow down and worship their gods, little g. According to this cylinder, they were all hurriedly recalled. Bring them in. Bring them in quickly. This was an action that many theorized that the Babylonians were fearful of some kind of campaign that was going to come against them. The cylinder also mentions, as I said, Belshazzar by name, my firstborn son and co-regent of Babylon. And that's where we pick up the story. Remember what Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar his dream meant when he saw the polymetallic idol or the big statue, head of gold and chest and arms of silver and on. And Daniel understood what the dream meant because the Lord revealed it to him. And he said that your kingdom, Nebuchadnezzar, is going to fall. And then next will come the Medo-Persians. In chapter 5, Cyrus the Great, who is a Persian, what is today in the region of Iran. And they had a tremendous society there. And there was another group of people, a large ethnic group that were known as the Medes. And they were a fearsome warrior group. Because of his expertise and a few other political serendipitous series of events, Cyrus the Great unites those two great big powers into what would become known as the Medo-Persian Empire. And he is rolling over Lydia, which was a great big nation. And he was rolling over Egypt, and he was rolling over one after the other. And he had his eyes and the crosshairs of his bow now set on the jewel of the entire region, the great city of Babylon. And what does Belshazzar do when he hears the tens of thousands of troops are becoming amassed upstream of the great Euphrates River? And then he hears tidings that Cyrus has taken the city of Opis. Big deal, says Belshazzar. Bring in all the idols, close the door, and we're just going to sit behind our 300-foot-high walls. Let them come. Let's pick up the story. Chapter 5, verse 1. Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. So instead of preparing for war in any respect, what does he do? He throws a party. We're fine behind our 300-high-foot walls. Let them come. Verse 2. And while he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar, really his grandfather, had taken from the temple of the Jews. In 606 BC, Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to Jerusalem and defeated her. But he left the temple and the city of Jerusalem intact as he installed a vassal king. Better do what we say. Yes, promised the vassal king. And then, as you know the story, he went away. And this vassal king got to listening to the wrong and the false prophets. You should rebel. It's a God thing. And they forgot to look at the book of Jeremiah. Israel, you're going to go away in captivity for 70 years because of your disobedience. No, said the false prophet to the vassal king in Jerusalem. That Jeremiah doesn't know what he's talking about. They stage a coup of sorts. Nebuchadnezzar has to come back a second time, lay siege once again, and destroy the opposition. But he left the temple in place, left another vassal king, and then said, you better obey. And did that king? Nope. And he came back the third time. And this time is when he destroyed Jerusalem and the temple specifically. And it must have been at that third siege and the destruction of the temple is when he took the vessels that were fashioned by Solomon. They come back after 70 years, and then they rebuild the temple under Ezra and Nehemiah. So the beautiful temple that Solomon had constructed and all the beautiful gold and the vessels, cups and saucers and utensils were all taken back to Babylon. But it would seem that Nebuchadnezzar took tender care of those elements. Remember in chapter 3, what did he say? If anybody speaks against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're going to have to answer to me. And then in chapter 4, the Lord God, Jehovah, is God. So likely Nebuchadnezzar was very sensitive about these elements. What about his grandson? We're having us a party. We've run out of solo red cups. So what are we going to do? Let's break into the treasury and let's get the beautiful holy vessels consecrated to Jehovah God, and let's drink alcohol from them. Oh my. Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, Belshazzar and his lords, his wives and his concubines. This is a drunken, sexually out of control situation, and they are mocking the God of Israel. Verse 3, And the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine, and they praised the god of gold and silver and bronze and iron, wood and stone. Verse 5. And in the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. There are many colloquial terms in our society that come from the Bible. Have you ever heard that one? You know, the handwriting is, and it comes from this actual story here. Before Saddam Hussein was killed, when he was rebuilding Babylon, he reconstructed this actual hall. And he did so per the instructions and the understandings and the archaeological discoveries of Robert Coldaway. They knew where this great hall was. And some of you who remember the shock and awe of Desert Storm, some of the pictures and video featured was this actual reconstructed hall under Saddam Hussein. That gives chills to me. And many of our soldiers commented on that. And I understand that there were the chaplains who read them this story of Daniel chapter 5 and the account of the writing on the wall. By the way, whose fingers do you suppose these are? It's not the Yellow Pages guy. It's not that guy. I believe it was Jesus. I really do. You might want to circle that, the fingers of the Lord, and then write John chapter 8. They caught her, this adulteress, in the very act, and throw her down at Jesus' feet. They were trying to trip him up, because the law said if you're caught in adultery, of course, the penalty would be death. Notice they didn't bring the dude, just the girl, because the dude was probably working for the Pharisees and Sadducees. He's not there, she is. She's thrown down, perhaps even naked or close. And they say, what are you going to do now, Mr. Messiah man? If he says, let her go, well then he broke the law and we got him. If he says, stone her, then so much for being a friend of sinners. We're so smart, they thought. And then you remember the narrative of that gospel says, he bent down and he wrote in the dust with his... For you Bible students, the first time that Moses goes up Mount Sinai and gets the commandments, the 613 some do's and don'ts, collectively known as the law, who wrote the first copy? God did, with his finger. It's so wonderful to get a concordance or get a concordance in your computer program and look up finger of the Lord or finger and chase down every mention of it, and it begins to paint a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful story. The same finger that wrote, thou shalt not, is the same finger who's writing, as we'll see here in a minute, mene, mene, tekel upharsin, curtains for Belshazzar, and is the same finger who wrote in the dust of John chapter 8. Now, what did he write? We don't know. My favorite conjecture is he was writing the times and the places where the men who had the rocks ready to go, where they met up with this woman. That's my favorite story. Because I remember one by one they dropped the rocks and they left. Oh, what a tender story. Woman, he says to her, gone, which is a title of great respect. He called his mom by the same name. Where are your accusers? And she said, sniffling probably, they're not here. How many witnesses did it require to convict? Now she was there. She's obviously a witness. Where are her other witnesses? They left, leaving only one witness, her. And because it takes two witnesses to convict, Jesus within the law says, then neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. It's the same finger. The finger that could split granite rock with the Ten Commandments. And the same finger that could rightfully sear into the plaster of a bunch of terrible, unrepentant people mocking God and His holiness, etching into the plaster, is the same finger that wrote tenderly in the presence of a woman busted for her sin. And it's going to be the same fingers that are going to wrap around you and me when we arrive. A lot going on here with this finger. You know, God could have done it any way He wanted. He could have just went poof, and then these words could appear. He could have had an angel show up, but He wants to show this, the finger. Verse 6, and then the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that his joints of his hips were loosened. A bit more careful of a study, joints is the Chaldean, Persian word, is ketar, and it literally means knots, like a knot in a piece of string or rope, so that the knots of his hips, that's the Persian word karats. It means loins or bowels. You are reading the polite version. You know what this really says? The knots in his bowels were loosened. Do you know what that means, everybody? And his knees knocked one against the other. Lord Nelson, the great English admiral of the English fleet. He one time happened upon a Spanish galleon, and of course they were consistently at war. When he sighted the one galleon, he said to his boy, he says, quick, run and get my red waistcoat, which was a kind of a coat of some kind. And then he would see another Spanish galleon, quick, run and get my red waistcoat. And finally the boy said, Lord Nelson, why do you have me fetch the red waistcoat before battle? He said, because if I'm hit and I bleed, you won't see the blood and it won't sort of demoralize the troops. Oh, pretty good idea. And then within a few months, they rounded the corner and they ran into the whole Spanish armada. And he says to the boy, quick, fetch my brown breeches. Love that story. Here is Belshazzar, party. You're not going to get us. We got 300 high-foot walls. Bring all the articles from that Jewish temple. Some God he is. And here come the fingers on the wall. And his bowels were loosed, and his knees knocked against each other. Did you guys catch the eclipse on Monday, right? That was pretty cool. We had our glasses. My wife is awesome. She looked far and wide because we waited perhaps a bit long, but we found a contact, and she had to meet the contact for our glasses in a parking lot. Exchange money and then the paper sack, you know. I hope none of you guys saw her. What is Nicole doing over there exactly? She met her source. Anyway, so we got the glasses and we were looking and it was pretty amazing.
You've been listening to the powerfully prophetic Book of Daniel with Pastor Steve Hadley of Harvest Family Fellowship in Reno. Daniel continues to show us that because God so obviously knows and guides the future of nations, He certainly knows and guides our future as well. What a great comfort that we may not know what the future holds, but Daniel shows us who does hold the future. If you missed any of today's message or would like to hear it in its full, unedited format, You can watch this or any of Pastor Steve's teachings at our website. Just visit us at harvestreno.org. That's www.harvestreno.org. Come join us Sundays at 10:30 and Wednesday evenings at 6:30. Harvest is located at 350 South Rock Boulevard in Reno. Until next time, Pastor Steve encourages all of us to follow Acts 2:42 and Word, Worship, Prayer, and Fellowship every day. May the Lord bless you and keep you as we are washed by the water of the Word.